I'm Christopher Lydon with Roger Owen, the Harvard eminence on Middle East history. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Arab Presidents for Life. Think Mubarak in Egypt, Gaddafi in Libya, Assad next, it would seem, in Syria. He's getting us started in a conversational immersion over there about the season after the Arab Spring. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. We're taking the conversation this fall to North Africa and Egypt. But study hall first, Roger Owen. What is the long view, in your terms, of whatever it is that's unfolding here?
Well, the long view is the emergence of people power led by young people and a real desire to transform the way in which they're governed and possibly their whole society. And that's very powerful, and that extends even to monarchies like Saudi Arabia. But the creation of a new political structure after a revolution, where you have to have a constitution and elections and so on, is an extraordinarily difficult process. All we know is that in a republic where the people are sovereign, ideally they all participate in the remaking of their political system, but fitting everybody in, the religious and the traditionalists and so on, as well as the revolutionaries, is very complicated, and that's where we are at the moment. A lot of trouble around constitutional assemblies in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia.
You call it a revolution, like the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, the American Revolution. What kind of revolution? And why not just dear old Arab Spring?
I think revolution because I think it is agreed in when you have a world revolution like the American or the French or the Russian or the Chinese, it does involve a desire by a very large number of people to replace an old and what they regard as completely archaic political system by something completely new. And that means that's root and branch. It means a new constitution. It means a new elections. It means a new way of doing politics. And that's very complicated. The more people involved, the more complicated it is.
Where are we in the famous stages of revolution?
Well, I think the French, of course, renamed everything. We had year one, year two. We're in year two of the revolution. And there'll probably be 5-10 more years of revolution before you can say that a new, stable, properly accepted political system has been created.
The end of Ottoman rule around World War I, and then of the European colonial domination of North Africa and Egypt after World War II, made way for these strong men that you write about, presidents for life. What is the pattern to replace that one?
Well, I think we're not just talking about the Arab world when we talk about dictators and authoritarian regimes. We're talking about what happened in most of the post-independent states, probably in Latin America in the 19th century, certainly in large parts of Asia in the 20th century. And there are particular reasons why you should have strong authoritarian states, because they felt the people felt that their sovereignty was very fragile, they might be reinvaded, all kinds of things. So it was natural that strong leaders and authoritarian states that controlled the national territory should emerge. And now we're in stage two, and most people think that these states should give way, these systems should give way to pluralist democratic systems, but nowhere has this been tremendously well done in the Arab world, certainly so far. So it's history in the making still.
You have a wonderful summary, almost in one sentence, toward the end of your book, in which you say the reality in Egypt for a 30-year-old Egyptian was that he'd never known a national chief other than Hosni Mubarak, and that he would never know a national chief other than Hosni Mubarak's son. It didn't happen that way. Do we know yet just why it cracked at this point?
Well, I think there was a demonstration effect. So it cracked in Tunisia. So you have to talk about that. And then it extended. But I think it was, there was enormous resentment, and there was much more civil society than we had imagined, those of us who used a rather strong notion of authoritarianism. There were civil society organizations like trade unions and student organizations that once the regime showed some sign of weakness, and once it was revealed the regime was not going to kill everybody, except in Syria, who resisted, people pushed through the door, and everybody had a or large numbers of people had a particular reason for wanting the old regime to fall. For some economic, some wanted work, some wanted dignity, some wanted future, some didn't want to have to go to America for their education or whatever. There was a huge bundle of pent-up forces of people who disliked the way that they were being ruled by a single person and the way that this single person seemed to be saying that my son will succeed me or some family member, quite apart from the corruption and the cronyism.
Focus on Egypt, please, Roger Owen. Sitting there geographically at the center of the Arab world, in terms of population, the biggest country in the Arab world, you've said that the Egyptians need their own new framework of their modern history to encompass Nasser and the socialist revolution in the 50s, and then Sadat, who made peace with Israel, and then Mubarak, who seemed progressively more and more under the thumb of the American government, and then the revolution. I mean, how would you explain this modern history to an Egyptian?
Well, I think it's not unlike other parts of the Third World in which you fall under European influence. You're ruled by a foreign-speaking elite who are very often large landowners and so on, with subject peasants. The social inequities lead to some form of popular revolution and upset. And if it happens in the 1950s or the 1960s, you then move to the opposite of the new mode of a strong leader who's interested in modernization and development and seems to think that he can do it and that there can't be division and everybody must come together to meet the national challenges, which in Egypt are absolutely huge. Defeat by Israel, lack of industrialization, all kinds of things. They want to be like everybody else, modern, and that they think, at least initially, a sufficient number of people think that this should be done by one man and one party. For that to happen for a while, and then they begin to see the disadvantages of this, and Sadat and Mubarak move away a bit in terms of trying to introduce some kind of electoral democracy. But in the case of Mubarak, over time, falls back on well-tried ways because he feels he's threatened by religious movements and so on, and digs in.
Place General Nasser in that history a little more precisely. I mean, he was the last pharaoh, people like to say, the greatest leader of the Arab world in the modern time, and more controversial sort of since then. The Nasserite candidate placed third, almost unremarked, in the presidential election in Egypt. What does that mean? What is left of the Nasser project?
Well, I think it made sense at the time. He seemed to be a modern person. He was in the army. The army seemed to be a way of getting things done. The politicians had allowed themselves, Egypt, to be defeated by the Israelis and so on. But then after a while, after great planning and mighty schemes and I think a realization that great men make great mistakes, people wanted to amend that in some kind of way and bring in pluralism and electoral politics and so on. And that happened in rather haphazard fashion under Sadat and early Mubarak. And then they got trapped again under late Mubarak, who was digging in and preparing his son to succeed him and surrounded by cronies. So there was a call for a second revolution, the first one being against the British, basically, and the second one being in the same place, Tahrir, Liberation Square, on behalf of the people who had benefited only partially from the authoritarian reforms.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about. Isn't it plausible still to see Egypt and the Arab Revolution as a kind of decolonizing project? Egypt was invaded by Napoleon in 1798. It was dominated by Britain through the 1950s when Nasser took over. It was dominated by the United States pretty much since Nasser. And since Nasser, with Soviet help, was whipped by Israel, which had American help. And so now they're insisting on their own identity once again. I mean, isn't this a kind of replay of the decolonizing project?
Well, you could argue that, but it's different people are involved. I think a very small number of nationalist politicians and then army politicians are involved the first time around. And as I say, they tried to accelerate modernity, and they got the Soviet Union to help them. And this time, I think it's a feeling that that the people must be involved in this new project. and that that's the modern thing to do. Democracy is the way, and that if Egypt is going to find itself a place in the modern world, and Egyptians are going to feel that they are properly modern, they need a new political system.
What might General Nasser be telling his people about this tension of democracy and powerful leadership?
I should just say he was never general. He got no further than colonel.
Sorry.
He never promoted himself. That was one thing in his favor. It depends which Nasser. He died remarkably young in his 50s. If he'd lived on, it might have been different. I think he knew all these things in his head, that there were other aspirations and so on. But he did, in 68, admit to various faults and try and set off in a different direction where things were slightly more open politically and economically, and this was built on by his successor. So I think he might be quite fatalistic about it and say that the system was okay, but it had a kind of self-correcting mechanism in it, and it moved in the right direction until, I expect, he would admit that Mubarak messed it all up in some way.
So again, what does it tell us that this man, Hamdin Sabahi, the Nasserite, got 20% of the vote in this election against the candidates of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Mubarak rump? Is that a vote for socialism? Is it a vote for strongman government? Is it nostalgia? What does it mean?
Well, I think sometime in the 1980s, even the staunchest Nasserites came to turn against him and realized that the security state and torture and delusions of grandeur of Nasser had been a bad thing in the end. And as I say, he may have built the Aswan Dam, which people may think is a good thing, but also the state industry and employing everybody and secure jobs and so on was not a way forward, and that he infantilized the people. And so I don't think there's any Nasserism to build on anymore. I mean, there isn't the same kind of desire for freedom or autonomy or rapid development as there was. Or if there is, it's for doing it in some alternative way. I mean, with the fall of the Soviet Union, quite a lot of that disappeared. The plan, the big projects, the feeling you have to have heavy industry to be modern. The world changed and Egyptians rethought where they were needed to be within it.
The world is getting a good look now at Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood in the presidency. He went to prison for the Brotherhood, and now he's in charge. What does he look like to you?
Well, I think he's half good, three-quarters good, in the sense that he, like many of the brothers, used their time in prison to rethink their attitude, and they feel that the democracy can be managed by in a Muslim country in a way that either achieves Islamic aims or doesn't end, see them defeated by secularists and so on. So he has thought out these kinds of things. But when it comes to practical politics and managing the country and managing international relations and realizing that you need help from the IMF, of course, he is finding some political skills. But I think the problems are so great that he's floundering at the moment. And he may take refuge in the fact that he is the president, and people are probably telling him to be tough and do this, that, and the other. So it's tricky. And his character is being revealed, and I don't think that we can really say with much confidence where all this is going to end.
We're conditioned to expect the worst from the Muslim Brotherhood, but what I notice about him is that he looks so much like the eternal mayor of Boston, Tom Menino. I mean, sort of stolid, confident, man of few words, but fairly clear in the case of Mohamed Morsi. He looks like anything but a religious radical. He looks like a professional engineer, which we discover so many of the Brotherhood are. Doctors, lawyers, professionals, but not red hots.
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, his politics, he learned his politics in the Muslim Brothers, and I think that's pretty tough politics. And so he knows how to accommodate, how to isolate people, how to postpone decisions by creating a committee. He has some of the tricks up his sleeve. But I don't think that he knows really long-term where he wants to take Egypt. I think he probably sees the most important thing is the new constitution and a transition to a new political order in which the Muslim Brothers will have a place, but they'll have to accommodate and make alliances with other people. But in the short term, of course, under pressure from his constituency, he may be bending his own rules, for all we know, finding a way of using job creation in order to employ only Muslim Brothers, something of that kind. So he's not in charge entirely, and he knows that he's not in charge.
Morsi's suggestion is that he is an Egyptianist, as opposed, say, to a pan-Arabist or an Islamist. Egyptianist in the sense, very broadly, of let Egypt be Egypt, the land of the pharaohs and the pyramids and the Nile, and the center, in a certain sense, of the Arab world. Not a bully, necessarily, but the leader. A big country, historic country, you know, maybe the oldest civilization in the world. What would that mean if indeed that's what he wants? What does his Egyptianism mean? What does your Egyptianism mean?
Well, I think Egypt is a wonderful place and full of very talented people, very important, long history, as you say, very confident in its Egyptianness. But I think it's been aware, most people in Egypt, that its full potential has not been realized. So they're waiting for, I think, a moment at which the talents of more than a small number of Egyptians can be used in various kinds of ways, economic nation building, dealing with the terrible problems of water and salination and all that kind of thing. And I think they're also aware that they've never really sat down and worked out their place in the world. They've always said no to certain kinds of things. We don't want to be ruled, but what is Egypt for? That's up for grabs. And the sad thing about Egypt would be if that kind of thinking gets subordinate to short-term electoral calculations. We need to have a plan. We need to have a group of people, think tanks, something or other, that sit down and say, what is Egypt's competitive advantage? What can Egypt do? Where should resources be sent? And how can we become a really great country?
Does he have to fight with the Brotherhood for that Egyptianist identity, fight with Muslim Brotherhood leaders elsewhere in the Arab world? Does he have a battle with the Islamist tendency or fashion in the Muslim world?
Well, he has a battle with the Salafis, who are outside government at the moment, who very clearly want have their own views about an Islamic state. He has a battle with the Muslim Brother obscurantism, in that they're largely ideological people and they can organize, but they're not the kinds of people who will have much to say about the Egyptian economy or the banking system or the IMF. That's not their bag. He knows that they need technocrats and experts to do that kind of thing. How he will go about doing that, I don't know. I mean, the nationalism of everybody is absolutely clear. The Brothers are the Brothers in Egypt. Hassan al-Banna, who founded the Muslim Brothers, was an Egyptian nationalist. It's always been an Egyptian project. So what we're seeing is fitting in religion, political religion, in a country which is Muslim in a way that is satisfactory to the Islamic trend, but also in a way that doesn't harm the technical, economic, social development of the country.
President Morsi announced a fascinating initiative with respect to Syria to ally with the Saudis, the Iranians, and the Turks to ease the transition, so to speak, in Syria. The idea got a very bad press in the United States, but I think it still sounds more workable than the idea of the United States and NATO intervening. And it also plays very well with the whole idea of a big Egypt playing a big regional role. What do you make of that idea?
I think it's an extremely good idea, and I suspect that if Obama wins the election, he will go along with that, or at least recognize that he has to cut Morsi some slack and he should be allowed to develop because he's not fundamentally harmful to American interests. But the problem always is not just Israeli fears of this new government, but the Israeli constituency in North America, which will see any powerful Egyptian government doing anything that tries to organize the Middle East in a way that excludes the Israelis as dangerous, potentially dangerous.
Hasn't the American interest, so-called, been discounted here? President Morsi says pretty bluntly that he wants a new relationship with the United States and the West, and that the old relationship, he says, was essentially purchased by the United States, and that it cost us Americans, any real friendship with the people of the region. What shrinkage of the American interest should we be prepared for?
Well, I think that's complicated. I mean, I think he's saying that American interests are allied with oil interests or something of that kind, and that they haven't respected the wishes of the people. And I think that's something that Obama in a second term could deal with quite well. I mean, clearly, it seems to me that a lot of the democracy promotion and stuff that's been going on in Egypt has been a complete waste of time. The NGOs are not NGOs under Mubarak and so on. So I think there is the making of a new relationship. You have a huge Egyptian diaspora here in America who can be mobilized. So I think you have something to work on.
What if we're looking at a first Romney administration, not a second Obama?
That depends on so many things. I mean, Romney speak at the moment, and his lack of knowledge of the area doesn't bode well. Then a lot will depend on who his Secretary of State is and how much influence they allow to Bibi Netanyahu and what is going on in Israel and so on. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine a Romney administration saying, sitting down and looking at it, and I mean, like Romney being a consultant and problem solver and so on, and saying, there is something we have to address here, and who shall I talk to? So I wouldn't be enormously worried about a Romney danger.
But there is that other Romney who sort of encouraged Bibi Netanyahu to do what he must with Iran, and also takes a very dim view of the Arab Spring in general, and thinks that President Obama has kind of patronized it and allowed something unhealthy for all of us. I think that's a persistent thread in American life.
Yes, although I think, again, I think, you know, Romney is a businessman and a problem solver and so on. He's not basically ideological, although he is persuaded of certain kinds of things that he thinks he believes strongly. But when it comes to management and government, it doesn't seem to me that he trails too many things behind him, provided he doesn't fill his cabinet full of wild people who want to attack Iran or are completely blinkered about Israel.
Obama or Romney, what room is there for real change in the relationship with a boisterous, new, self-filled Egypt, do you think? And also, what has to change in the relationship?
Well, I don't think that Egypt is of enormous importance, provided it will keep the peace treaty and look after Sinai and so on, I think the Egyptian army wants to be... The Egyptian military officers are very all trained in America and want an army that is supplied by the Americans. So I think American basic interests are not threatened by a Morsi administration. And then Egypt has to find its own place. If Egypt is Egypt and not the leader of the Arab world anymore, then you have an Egyptian policy and not an Arab policy. And it finds its own level alongside Venezuela or... where else can I think? Indonesia or somewhere other.
Last question. What is the cultural piece, Roger Owen, of this revolution? The expressive piece, the piece of in literature, in music, in art, in Egypt's statement of itself as a cultural player, cultural voice, both in fomenting the revolution and now in sort of living with it and exporting it and being it.
I think it's like any revolution in which people get tremendously excited. They experiment. They feel able to think and do all kinds of things that they'd never done before. So that comes into literature. It'll come into architecture. It'll come into all kinds of things. Sooner or later, it's unstoppable. That particular thing, that people who felt held back, cynical, now feel that they can use their capacities and their intellect and their imagination in ways they never have before. In that sense, it's revolutionary, like Paris in 1789 or any of these other moments of Russia in 1917 when lots and lots of things became possible which hadn't been possible before.
I'm just beginning to notice the power of the cultural voice of Egypt in our world everywhere. The gateway to the Mount Auburn Cemetery, for example, the gateway to the old granary burying ground in the heart of the city of Boston, the Neo-Egyptian or Egyptian revival architecture all over the world, not to mention the legacy of the pyramids and the mummies and all of that history. I never knew until recently that the weighing of hearts, for example, is an Egyptian idea. Immortality is virtually an Egyptian idea. I mean, can one imagine what Egypt is going to do for us next?
Well, I don't know. I think you're describing a particularly American phenomenon. I don't think that goes on in England for reasons that I don't know, but go back to American history. This sense, Americans are familiar with Egypt. Very large numbers have been there. Mummies, pharaohs, all that kind of thing seem to resonate within the American imagination, probably in horror films too, entombment and so on. And that's a great cultural asset for the Egyptians if they know how to make that link with Americans. I mean, it may go against what the Egyptians feel about themselves, that they don't want to be constantly reminded of mummies, but they'd like to be, you know, the Egyptian who won the Nobel Prize is much more important to them.
Egyptomania was a very Bostonian thing. I mean, the collections at Harvard and the Boston Museum of Fine Arts are some of the greatest in the world, and it was a tremendous industry here in the 1870s through the 20s and the discovery of King Tut's tomb. But there was a little bit of Egyptomania revived in the moment of Tahrir Square, too. Have we seen the end of Egyptomania?
I would think so. It'll have to come in another kind of way, in the usual kind of way, through popular songs and culture that's much more accessible and movies made in Egypt and so on, and charismatic young persons appearing from Egypt and doing this, that, and the other. The mummies will always be there, but it's all a bit dead, I think. It's like a desire to enter the elaborate tombs and think about the underworld and so on. It's a good story. It's a terrific story.
Let's hope it has a future. Roger Owen, thank you for the big picture. And off we go.
And so we go off, yes, indeed. I'm happy to talk to you.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Roger Owen. He is the A.J. Meyer Professor of Middle East History at Harvard. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Arab Presidents for Life. Listeners, this begins our homework, so to speak, for a trip in November to Egypt, sampling the fruits of the Arab Spring of last year. More than ever, it's your comments and leads that round out the conversation. So leave your comment, please, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the project.